Michael Tonsmeyer joins me this week to talk about sour beer brewing. This is Beersmith Podcast number 209.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 209. It's late February 2020. Michael Tonsmeyer joins me this week to discuss sour beer brewing. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the Brew Easy. Brew big in small spaces with the best all-grain, ultra-compact system available. The Brew Easy's revolutionary setup combines batch sparge efficiency, brew-in-a-bag simplicity, and the work clarification of a rim system. It's easy to set up, easy to operate, and easy on the eyes. Add the optional Brew Commander for precise temperature control and mash automation. With a Brew Easy, you'll discover definitive proof that size isn't everything. Electric and propane models are available. It's also the system that I brew on. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith 3 software a try. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider recipe support to the Beersmith platform, along with new integrated water profile and mash pH tools. Dozens of new features, including cloud folders, updated databases, support for fruit juice and honey, as well as new Whirlpool hop options. Download your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com and give it a try. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Michael Tonsmeyer. Michael is the author of the book, American Sour Beers, as well as author of the blog, The Mad Fermentationist. Michael is also an award-winning brewer, certified beer judge, and founder of the brewery Sapwood Cellars, where he joins us from today in Columbia, Maryland. How are you, Michael?
It's good to be here. I'm doing well. It's nice to be talking to you from somewhere other than my bedroom.
Your bar's not too busy today. I can see it there in the background.
No, we're just open Wednesday to Sunday, and it's a gray Tuesday evening, and so it's pretty quiet back there.
So how are things going? We talked about 10 or 15 episodes ago about Sapwood Cellars, and you were just in the middle of opening it at the time.
Yeah, it's still going great. I mean, I'm still not regretting leaving my desk job of 11 years to do beer stuff every day. We just hired a full-time brewer, and so now we've got someone else cleaning kegs in addition to my partner Scott and myself. And we're waiting on some new tanks and filling barrels and filling bottles, and it's an experience. And I don't know, I'd recommend it to every home brewer, but certainly if beer is your life, you might as well get paid for it.
It certainly looks more cozy than a cubicle there. I don't know.
Yeah, a little bit, and the beverages are a little bit better too.
That's true. Well, today you wanted to talk a little bit about your book, Sour American Beer, and some of the new developments you've learned since you published the thing. Why don't we start with talking a little bit about the book itself and, when you published it and so on.
Sure. It came out in, I think, 2014. I'd worked on it for about 3 years before that, first on my own and then with Brewers Publications sort of backing, and we had a bunch of great editors. But honestly, sour beer in America has really only been a big topic for, say, maybe 20 years now, but probably a little less than that. Yeah. And so the fact that the book is already 6 years old, a lot has changed since then. And, being a blogger for a long time, it was always great that you could always post an update or, change your opinion on something. And one of the issues with the book is, at the moment, it's out there. There's been one revision that was just little ticky-tack stuff. You know, this was really on that page, or I misspelled a Belgian town's name or something along those lines. But there have been a lot of changes to how brewers approach sour beers. There's been new research. There have been new techniques that brewers have sort of gone after. And it's nice to have a little, let's say, mid-cycle update. Hopefully in 4 or 5 years, I do another book, with my professional experience kicking in. And but before then, it's sort of nice to take stock of where we are.
And you mentioned there's been a lot of new research on sour beers. There's also a lot more resources available now, right?
Yeah. When I first started making sour beers, it was really Jeff Sparrow's Wild Brewing or Wild Brews, which was just sort of about Lambic and Flemish Red and Oud Bruin. And, my blog became sort of a source for people, but it was really just sort of this ad hoc, what I did on that batch or what my opinion was, over time changing. And so I think the book was well timed, and I've talked to, hundreds of homebrewers and dozens of professional brewers about, it gave them the confidence to start or that it kicked them off in the right direction, but they've, sort of found their own path after that. But more recently, resources like the Sour Hour podcast has been fantastic from Jay at the Rare Barrel and the Milk the Funk group, which is a huge group of homebrewers and craft brewers on Facebook, and they have a wiki page. And it's great just because there are all these sources for information on the science, the practical questions, the flavor combination questions. Not to mention, podcasts like your own that now have, pretty regularly on somebody who does is from a yeast lab or a brewery that specializes in spontaneous fermentation or all those sort of great, professional, thoughtful people who have opinions and think of ways to do things that I wouldn't have even imagined if you'd given me 100 years to write the book.
And the other thing is, I think there's been quite an expansion of commercial beers too here, at least here in the U.S. that are sour, right?
Yeah, and not only just the number of beers that are sour, but the number of breweries that are almost entirely focused on sour beer. Places like Casey Brewing and Blending, Black Project, Holy Mountain, Santa Darius. That really, I think with beer, the more you can focus on one thing, the better you get it at. If you're a brewery that does a lot of IPAs, you're going to learn about hop selection and dry hop timing and whirlpool temperature and yeast interactions. And sort of the same thing for sour beers. Once you learn how to use fruit and where to source barrels from and the best sources of microbes, you can apply those lessons to all of your beers and really just sort of keep raising that quality, that consistency, and get a product that is something that's difficult for someone who only does a sour beer once a year to sort of see that that level of quality.
And the last time we chatted, I think you were doing a number of sour and barrel aged beers too, right?
Yeah, like any kind of long term project like that, it's taken a long time for us to get to the point where it's something we can do regularly. And so we opened in September 2018, and our first sour barrel-aged mixed fermentation with Brettanomyces barrel-aged sour funky beer was a year later. It was September 2019, and we've done 10 releases since then. We've got one coming up this weekend that was aged in gin barrels. We've got an Imperial Flanders Red, like a 10% vin de cereal we aged in port barrels that we're blending later this week, and we've got a dark saison that was soured in local red wine barrels that's going on to figs. And so we've now finally got that 60 or so barrels of stock that we can blend and we can put onto fruit. And the idea is that we just keep refilling those barrels as time goes on. And luckily so far, the response has been fantastic. The bottles sell out usually within a week or two. And we've got a sour beer club that people sort of buy into, and they get bottles as the year goes on, and it's been a really exciting and rewarding couple of months for us.
That's something I was going to ask. Are most of these special releases, or do you actually are you getting to the point where you have sour beers on tap regularly now?
So we have some sort of, let's call them quicker sours. We don't do a lot of kettle souring, but we'll add lactobacillus to get the acid and then ferment it out either with 100% Brett or a saison yeast or something like that. And those are on tap regularly, and we'll do some like keg condition, naturally conditioned Berliner Weiss, Goza, Saison. They have a little funk and some acid, but for the most part, the barrel-aged stuff is just bottles. We do try to keep bottles around, so we have in-house options And now we've started the last couple of Sundays, but it won't continue indefinitely. We put cases of beer away. We reserve them from releases and then have vintage Sundays where a case of this last Sunday was an apricot beer that we did. We take out a case and it's available for in-house consumption just to add a little bit more depth. We only have 10 taps, and so it's there's always a struggle to have a real variety of beers available.
So back to the book, American Sour Beers. What are some of the things you think you got wrong in the book? You said now that you maybe got a couple things not quite right.
Sure. I mean, to me, the sort of the two biggest areas were about lactobacillus and about Brettois. And, okay. You know, I'd like to say that neither of these is on me, but, you know, it's your book and you put your stamp on it. And I got some stuff wrong.
So you want to go over maybe the first one there, lactobacillus, I guess.
Sure. So one of the things that I've got a quote from the book. If you want to attempt this, so I was talking about doing a fermentation with only lactobacillus, you need a highly attenuative, heterofermentative lactobacillus strain, like White Labs WLP-677.
Okay.
That seemed like good advice at the time. I talked to a brewer that said that they pitched pretty much just lactobacillus. Sure, they had a little bit of yeast in there. I tried it. I'd pitched just a tube of lactobacillus that I'd grown up, and it fermented out to 80% attenuation. And, you know, certainly I didn't really know what was in there other than I tossed this tube in. Mm-hmm. About a year after the book came out, Lance Shanner of Omega Labs did a test where he added super pure strains of lactobacillus. He added I think it was like cyclohexamine, an antifungal, an addition that would kill any yeast.
Okay.
And he checked on sort of what amount of alcohol, what amount of attenuation he would get from various White Labs, Y yeast, Omega Lab strains. And the answer was pretty much the most he got out of any of them was, in fact, that White Labs Lactobacillus Delbrueckii 677. It was only 0.3% alcohol.
So that's not a lot of fermentation going on there.
Nope. Huh? And the beer went from 1.037 to 1.032 or 3.
Is that the pH
gravity.
Oh, gravity, yeah. So did it generate any significant sourness? Did the pH drop a lot or not?
Yeah, that one went down to 3.72 pH. Okay. But it's amazing. Some of the other ones, like the White Labs Lactobacillus Brevis, only took the gravity down 4 points, and it got down to 3.14, so extremely sour with only 0.1% alcohol. And so really that's the answer.
So sweet and sour at that point, right?
Yeah, but that really you need a yeast of some sort if you want alcohol, either Brettanomyces or Saccharomyces. Something has to take the rest of those carbohydrates and turn them rather than into, mostly or sort of a decent amount of lactic acid.
So I assume probably even when we're doing kettle souring, there's probably some wild yeast going on there, or maybe some of the other experiments you did, there's some wild yeast there.
Exactly. And I do not have a lab training, and I'm sure with me growing up the cells, it probably wasn't, you know, we always talk about sanitation, not sterilization in brewing, but with yeast propagation, sterilization, you know, can be a real thing you need. If a couple of cells of yeast get in there, they can grow. And so I mean, the takeaway for me is that if you add, if you think you're just souring, you have just lactobacillus you've added, and you start seeing a lot of CO2 production, you start seeing that gravity really dropping, odds are some wild yeast has gotten in there. And that's not necessarily the end of the world or anything like that, but it's good to be
I would assume if you're doing kettle souring, that probably is happening, right? I mean, because you do see fermentation go on, right?
Yeah, you might see just a little bit. I've gone to, when I do kettle souring, I no longer use a wild culture from, say, grain. I buy, and usually it's the Omega Labs lactobacillus blend. It's consistent, it makes acid, but it doesn't do much else, and it does it very quickly.
So does that have any yeast in it, or is it still
it's 100%. It's just lactobacillus brevis and lactobacillus plantarum. And it's amazing how quickly lactobacillus grows. Even on this scale, we're doing, say, a 300-gallon batch. I'll make a 1 gallon starter of lactobacillus 24 hours before, and I'll see that gravity drop down. The pH drop down into the mid threes within 18 to 24 hours.
So it doesn't take much, huh?
No, it's those
bacteria are pretty effective, huh?
Yeah, they can double every about 20 minutes. I don't remember the exact number, but essentially if you double every 20 minutes for 24 hours, you could go from one cell to it's 57.
To filling the entire world, right?
Yep, exactly. Yeah. And that's under ideal conditions and all that. But I've talked to a couple of local brewers who had been buying, you know, $300 or $400 commercial pitches of lactobacillus. And I said, you can get an $8 homebrew pack and you can grow your own and, you know, get as quick or quicker results.
Interesting.
As long, again, as you're being clean and you're following your best process for keeping unwanted microbes out of there.
So you mentioned a second mistake, and I apologize. It slips my mind at the moment, but what was the second one you were going to talk about?
So the second one was, again, it was probably about a year later. In that case, White Labs had been advertising Brettanomyces Trois, and it was their version of sort of a fruity, good for primary fermentation strain. And
so is that that's a Brettanomyces with some high ester production, or how's
exactly.
It?
Yeah, okay. Big tropical esters, great for like 100% bread IPA or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were marking is equivalent to another commercial strain from BSI, which is a commercial specific yeast supplier out in Colorado. And I talked about them as if they were the same strain, and I'd use them. And here's my 100% bread IPA recipe. And it came out from White Labs. They did a little genetic test when they were sort of ramping up their microbiology program and gene testing everything. In fact, it was a wild Saccharomyces strain. So rather than being Brettanomyces Trois, they've now rebranded as Sac Trois. And it's still available. And I really appreciate that just the fact that they were wrong about what species it was or what genus it was doesn't change the fact that it was a great yeast that made a really fruity, fun product.
Saccharomyces, of course, is yeast, right? So it's got a yeast, apparently a yeast to bacteria blend then, I guess?
No. So they just misidentified it. So okay. It was, they had what they thought was a Brettanomyces, and in fact, it was a Saccharomyces. So it's one of those things that until you put it into a PCR and identify what genes it has, microbiology is a little trickier. You know, it's not quite as clear cut and obvious just from looking under a microscope or something like that. And they rebranded it. Now they have what is it called? Vrai. It's the Brettanomyces Trois Vrai. It's the true Brett Trois. And so now they sell both strains, and you can choose between them depending on what flavors you're looking for, what attenuation you're looking for. If you're comfortable using Brettanomyces, you know, some people might use the Sac Trois and be comfortable using that on their non-sour equipment, on sharing equipment with a clean strain. And so that's, you know, it's not a big deal, but, you know, I really appreciate when a lab sort of owns up to, you know, a mislabeling, a misbranding, and says, hey, it's still a good product, and we're still going to keep using it and keep selling it. And we've used it on a couple of beers here at the brewery, and kept using it at home. It's a good strain. It's just not technically a Brettanomyces.
Right, but Chris White doesn't make any mistakes, so that's surprising you, yeah. Right?
None of us do. I've certainly never made a beer.
He's a good friend. He's good. what are some of the new topics you're looking at for the next edition you mentioned?
Sure. There are a couple big ones. I really didn't get much into sort of the commercial side of things, and you know things like bottle conditioning at home. I'd add some sugar, maybe I toss a little dry yeast into the bucket, and, you know, 2 weeks later, 6 weeks later, 5 months later, the beer would be carbonated almost all the time, and that was good enough for me.
Yep.
That wasn't on production schedule. Well, now I'm at this brewery, now we're trying to, you know, you don't want to sit around.
Now you're worried about shelf stability, right?
Yeah, and so we're, you know, there's a lot out there on acid shock tolerance, on, you know, a very low pH is not a happy place for dry yeast to wake up, and the techniques that you can get into for acclimating yeast to that lower pH and getting them so they're really ready to go as soon as the sugar's added and bottle conditions ready.
We're gonna cover that in just a minute, right?
Yeah. And then there's also lactic acid production by yeast. So that was, again, it's probably, I don't have the direct quote in front of me, but I'm sure I said, if a beer is sour, bacteria is involved. Either lactobacillus or pediococcus or acetobacter, acid production is by bacteria, fermentation is by yeast. It turns out that's not correct. There are a bunch of strains out there, and now a lot of labs have started isolating them and propagating them and selecting them that will do everything. It's almost like a kettle sour all-in-one microbe. It will make lactic acid. It will make alcohol. It will sort of knock out the whole process by itself and maybe or maybe not make some fun flavors.
Very cool. So can you give us some examples of those strains? Are they commercially available now?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a tricky area. This is one of those areas where people are attempting to patent the process.
Okay.
So there are certain labs, there are a couple of labs at colleges that have said, hey, we've applied for a patent. To make a sour beer, you pitch this particular strain of this microbe, and it makes a sour beer. There are luckily a couple of suppliers. Wild Pitch Yeast Co., Maniacal, and I'm sure a few others, but like those are the two I've worked with, and sort of, you know, their strains have been interesting. Some of the strains are sort of, you know, you may have heard of before. Hansiospora is I talked about a couple of times in the book. It's also called Chlorecala. It's supposed to Vinny Chulerzo from Russian River talked about having a culture at his brewery, sort of a wild culture that made these fun, like grapefruit flavors. Mm-hmm. He attributes some of the flavors they get, these like big citrusy flavors in their spontaneous fermentations, to this microbe, which they have in their blend or in their wild culture. And then there are like wicker hamomyces and schizosaccharomyces. And a lot of these strains that people find, they are just like out there in the world. I know
Are most of these coming from wild yeast sources, just wild stuff laying around? Yeah,
exactly. Like I know the ones from Wild Pitch Yeast Co. I think both of them were cultured off of trees from his parents' house in Pennsylvania. And he was just going around swabbing stuff.
Sounds like brewing in Belgium or something, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, but it's that, but it's a little bit more controlled because they're isolating them out. But really, that's sort of the thing with microbes, is that there are hundreds of millions of strains that haven't been identified, that have been identified in a bank, and just figuring out, like, well, one, like, sure, they make lactic acid, but, like, can they tolerate, you know, 5 or 6% alcohol? Do they make flavors that are pleasant? You know, you could make a perfect pH and have great attenuation, but if it makes your beer taste like rotten garbage, it's not really that good.
Yeah, I've had some wild yeast fermented beers that weren't to my taste anyways. I don't know.
Precisely. And some of that may be the strain, but some of it may just be learning, well, this isn't Saccharomyces. What's the right pitching rate? What's the right aeration level? What's the right nutrient amount? What's the right, what other kinds of ingredients does it play well with? Does it have fun interactions with hops? Does it do anything interesting with fruit? And that's really now where, you know, there's only so much a scientist can do before brewers just need to do that legwork of trying things out, seeing what works. You know, just like, I mean, essentially that's where most beer styles come from, is that, you know, people try something and refine it and figure out what works and what doesn't work and goes from there. And so I think they're really, it's a unique idea. It's nice in the sense that you don't have to worry about like a blend of yeast and bacteria where if you repitched it, the ratio of the different microbes would go one way or the other. You know, the bacteria probably reproduces more quickly. You also don't have to worry about hopping rate nearly as much. Lactobacillus generally is only tolerant to maybe 5 IBUs, best case scenario, 10 or 15. So if you want to do something that has, you know, acid and hop aroma, it can be very difficult to do that with bacteria. You might have to sour first and then heat it back up and add some hops and then ferment it with yeast and then dry hop. And it's a lot of effort, a lot of timing, a lot of consideration. It's a lot easier with one of these strains where you can simply make the wort like you normally would and pitch the yeast. And a couple weeks later, you have sour beer. Mm. That was one of my issues with the ones I tried, is they were a little slow fermenting. Matt Bachman from Wild Pitch Yeast Co. sent me samples. I think I pitched the tubes that he sent me like 2 days after he propagated them. And a week later, both of them were at about 25% attenuation, which, I mean, I just can't imagine being at a particularly a production scale and having, you know, 25% attenuation after a week. And they both finished out. They both got to, 70% attenuation or so.
But it took a while.
And it took considerably longer than a kettle sour would. Granted, it was a lot easier. There wasn't that, waiting for the right pH. But then you don't have that same level of control. With a kettle sour, you can wait until it's exactly the pH you want. Then you can heat it. What we do is we'll often just add some pre-isomerized hop extract if we're just doing it in a tank. When it hits, 3.4 pH, we add a little hexalone or a little tetralone, get that lactobacillus to stop, and then let the yeast take over from there. So it's an interesting idea. I think it just needs that refinement on, again, what flavors are right, what timing is right, what pitching rates are right. Maybe it needed more nutrient. Maybe it needed more oxygen than I expected. So I used it. It was YH72, which is Hansiospora vineae, and YH82, which was Wickerhamomyces anomalous. I believe he does not generally sell to homebrewers, although I don't know. Last I talked to him a few months ago, they were working on a partnership that would make these strains more widely available, but I haven't heard anything since then.
Well, we're looking forward to that. That'll be great. Yeah.
I just love options. I mean, that's the great thing, with whether it's hops or malts, if we all only use the same yeast and the same three malts and the same two hops, we're all making the same beer. Great to have, other options, other flavors out there.
Well, can you talk a little bit more about kettle sour? Maybe just give us a quick overview. I know a lot of people may or may not be familiar with it, but it's become really popular, obviously, because it's shorter production times, right?
Yeah, I think kettle sour, I mean, quick sours and kettle sours are great. They will never be the same thing as a barrel aged mixed ferment sour beer with Brettanomyces and all that. But if what you're looking for is some acidity to balance out a beer rather than bitterness.
Right.
Almost all beers are on sort of that sweet to bitter kind of spectrum. Sourness is a whole other kind of, Venn diagram or whatever it is.
Well, can you walk us through the process real quick? Sure. Only because it's something people can fairly easily do at home,
Yeah. And so generally what I suggest is get a pack of lactobacillus that you trust. I like either a lactobacillus brevis or a plantarum. You can get those from a Y Yeast or a White Labs or an Omega, or you can also go to your local supermarket and get a Good Belly probiotic or their probiotic pills. But no matter what one of those sources you pick, I would go with something fresh, something in code, whatever it is, and then make a starter of it the day before. I usually just use a weak dry malt extract, just sort of like you would for yeast, but maybe more to like 10-20 rather than 10-40. Mm-hmm. No hops. Make the starter and chill it down to say 95 degrees and pitch your lacto. By the next day, it should be tart. Usually, making yogurt or something with lactobacillus, 24 hours is usually about all it takes.
You mentioned how fast they reproduce. So
yeah, exactly. And so really what I'm interested in is just making sure I have a healthy, active culture. I never want to have warm wort that I'm not pitching something into that I'm confident about. Mm-hmm. Whether that is I'm pitching yeast or I'm pitching lactobacillus, I just want to make sure whatever it is raring to go and is going to do the work of protecting the wort so that some awful bacteria doesn't move in that either tastes terrible or makes me sick. So I would make my wort just like normal. I wouldn't add any hops. I'm in the camp of there's no reason to add 3 IBUs of Hallertau. It's just not going to... Like Budweiser's 12 IBUs. If you're making 3 IBUs, you're not going to taste it, but there is some chance that 3 IBUs will cause trouble for the lactobacillus. I think one thing people don't realize is that as the pH gets lower, as more acid is produced, the hop acids become more damaging to lactobacillus. So even if it starts souring okay and it gets down from 5 pH down to 3.8, well, that might be enough acid that now those hop acids are really going to cause trouble and the lactobacillus is going to stop souring.
Interesting.
And so I would just leave hops out. And it's not just IBUs. It can even dry hops.
Are you talking about in your starter or just the whole thing?
The whole thing. Unless, so like what I do for a sour IPA is once it gets to my desired pH, generally you pasteurize the wort, so you bring it back up to 175, 180. You could boil it even at that point if you wanted to. But then you could add your hops.
Right.
At that point, I like adding the hops at 175 or 180. You won't get a lot of bitterness from them. So no. If you're just looking for a hop flavor, hop aroma, that's a great time to add the hops with a sour base. Mm-hmm. And from there, you've heated up. Again, I like having a pH meter to test the pH before I make that decision.
Right. And I mean, what are we shooting for here in terms of a kettle sour pH?
It depends. We've found that 3.5 or 3.6 is not nearly as sour as most beer drinkers want their sour beer to be. And so we've moved most of our quick sours down to 3.3 to 3.4 seems to be mm-hmm. the good spot for us. It really depends, though, if you're adding in a lot of sweeter flavors, like pastry sours are now the cool thing. So essentially sour beer with lactose and vanilla and, you know, desserty fruit kind of flavors. You could probably go for an even lower pH on that because you're going to have all this sweetness to balance it out. And that's really the problem with tasting the wort after souring, but before fermentation, is you still have most of the malt sweetness there. And so even a beer that's at 3.3 or 3.4 won't taste super sour.
Right.
It's much like soda. A lot of soda is like 3.1 or 3.2 pH, but we just don't realize it because it has all of the sugar laid on top of that.
Right.
But once fermentation's done, all that sweetness is gone. All of a sudden, it really will have some punch to it.
Yeah, that makes sense. So then I assume you just finish it out much like you would a regular beer. You just add the yeast and let it go, right?
Yeah. The only sort of point of warning I would give would be that low pH is stressful on the yeast. And particularly once you get down below 3.1 or so.
I actually make a lot of meads and it's very easy for them to drop below 3 and then it starts stopping and then you end up with a mead that's insanely sweet.
And sweet and sour can balance, but it's nice if you're intending it to ferment out that it does. So for example, I would add yeast nutrient after souring just mm-hmm. to make sure there is fan, that there are, you know, microbe accessible zinc and all those other things that yeast crave, because lactobacillus may have used up a lot of that.
Now, do you ever try and raise the pH, or you ever get in a situation where you have to, you know, sometimes when I'm doing the meads, I do have to raise the pH, potassium bicarbonate, something like that.
Yeah. You know, I haven't yet. Luckily we just sort of, because it's my full-time job, we just sort of monitor while souring's happening and sort of catch it at the right point. For stouts and things like that, we'll just use baking soda. But yeah, something like potassium bicarbonate, if you don't want to add sodium, seems like a great idea. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I pitch like a big starter of yeast, you know, make sure it's like maybe 50% more, you know, think of it more like a lager repitch rather than an ale repitch. We'll talk about it a little bit, acclimating the yeast, but I generally don't find that to be necessary for primary fermentation just because there's a lot of sugar. I'm not pushing the pH too low. Right. And then also think about the strain you're using. I think most strains are okay down to 3.2 or 3.3, but once you start going lower, a lot of Kolsch strains are good. Something like French Saison is pretty unstoppable. Or you might want to start thinking about like 100% Brettanomyces or the Sactois, something that's going to be a little hardier. And not just be able to start that fermentation, but be able to finish it out.
Right. And you probably don't want the pH to go that low anyways, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And again, it's all, I mean, anything like this, it's personal taste. And so I like the acidity to balance out the flavors, but some people really want to get socked with a big acid, you know, rip your tongue off kind of thing. Just, you know, there are always people who want 1,000 IBUs, and there's always people who want a 3.0 sour.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if there's any other sort of general tips. Yeah, and the nice thing about kettle sour is at that point you've boiled it, and so the lactobacillus is dead, so you don't have to worry about cross-contamination with your other equipment or anything like that.
And it's the other big advantage, is just very fast, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's very quick. If you're planning to add fruit, I wouldn't wait until fermentation's entirely done. I would add it as fermentation's maybe slowing down a little bit. We had a batch that we added fruit, I think, probably a week after fermentation started, so maybe 2 or 3 days after it really was done. And it took about 4 days to see any re-fermentation of that fruit sugar. And we were getting to that point where we were all nervous of if, I mean, it tasted good, a little bit of sweetness doesn't, you know, balance as a sour, but if it then starts re-fermenting in the keg or the bottle, you're in real trouble.
Well, another thing to be aware of, depending on the fruit, a lot of fruits are acidic and they can drive the pH down even further, actually.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's something you really need to think about of where's your target pH and how much fruit are you adding? And is it something like blackberries, they're going to add a lot of acid? Or is it something maybe like a peach or something like that?
Extreme would be like black currants, right? Or cranberries. Exactly. Cranberries drive it way down too. A lot of acidity. Switching topic, you pretty much covered kettle souring. Let's switch topics to acid shock. What is that?
Yeah, so yeast essentially have a reaction. When they get exposed to acid, they just need to, they stop what they're doing, they halt growth, and they need time to adapt. And they change the way their metabolism goes, and they, if they are tolerant, will have this acid shock response and acid adaptation, and then they'll get going. So again, I generally don't find this to be a problem for kettle sours. You certainly could acclimate your primary fermentation yeast to acid. But so far, I haven't found it to be an issue as long as you're sort of above, say, 3.2.
So you mentioned it's more of a problem with bottling, I guess?
Yeah, for bottle conditioning. That's the worst place to wake up. There's almost no sugar. There's no oxygen. There's acid. There's no nutrients. There are stress, you know, stress releases from the yeast that autolyzes. And if you just toss some dry yeast in on top of your bottling bucket, most of that yeast is going to die. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe a third of the cells if you're lucky, but it might be all of them. I usually use wine yeast, and wine yeast is more tolerant of acid just because, you know, whether it's mead or whether it's a grape wine, you know, those tend to be pretty acidic already. They've been selected for.
Yeah, I mean, they get down close to 3, but again, if they drop much below 3, they die. So.
Yep. And so this would be particularly valuable, say, if you had a house ale strain, if you were planning on adding American ale yeast, which is just, Sierra Nevada or wherever American ale is from, they never have sour beer. That yeast is not ready for it.
So walk us through this process of acclimating yeast, I guess, trying to get it used to the acidity.
Yeah, so it really all came from Matt Bachman, again, of Wild Pitch East Kobe. He's also a PhD at University of Indiana at Champlain or something like that. I apologize, Matt, if you're listening. And so he'd been contacted by Upland Brewing, which is also in Indiana, and they said, hey, we've got this sour beer and we add yeast. We add our healthy culture of, you know, active fermenting yeast and nothing happens. They beer just sits in the bottle for, you know, 3 months or 6 months and nothing happens. And, you know, we don't know what to do. And so he sort of looked at the biology of it and he came up with this process. Mm-hmm. It is the sort of thing that it seems like you would do in a yeast lab. You take the starter culture, you mix it with very specific things like yeast extract peptones. And so you get this sort of super fortified yeast, and then you blend in some of the beer that you're going to add it to. And what that does is you're sort of essentially diluting the acidity of that beer with that starter culture.
I assume you do it over time too, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so you're giving it like 24 hours of sort of like almost training wheels. You're giving the yeast time to say like, hey, something's coming, get ready for it. And then you can pitch that whole thing in.
I think it kind of like for really high gravity meads, you actually worried about this thing called osmotic shock, where there's too much sugar in the wort or must, literally, and you have to slowly introduce the yeast, or it'll just die. You know,
exactly. I've been making some wines at home, and that seems to be a pretty common process in wine, where you take your rehydrated yeast and you every few minutes you add a little bit of the. The must to it just to, again, yeah, like bring it up to speed slowly. And so luckily, and I would suggest that your listeners go to milkthefunk.com and look for acid shock starters. There's 5 or 6 different methods that people, either escarpment labs or.
And then I want to make the point, this is something you can do at home, right?
Exactly. But so what they've done is that they've come up with more, homebrew friendly ingredients and techniques that essentially there's nothing magic about this particular combination of time, but getting the yeast rehydrated is a big step. Right. At a minimum, I would say, even if you don't want to go through all of this, rehydrate your yeast first, by the manufacturer's directions. If you want to use a product like GoFirm, which is a rehydration nutrient.
GoFirm is very good.
That's what we do. We just rehydrate with GoFirm, make sure the temperature is pretty close, and we just put that in. If you then want to go sort of that next step, people have different suggestions on, you know, sometimes it's using apple juice because that's a simple, you know, carbohydrate compared to malt. You may not want to be adding a whole bunch of malt extract, which is partially fermentable by the wine yeast you're adding, but also fermentable by Brettanomyces. You may want to be using more simple sugars if you're going to be propagating them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have, you know, particular times, you know, use this amount of GoFerm for that amount of time at that temperature, and then cool it, and then, you know, over and over. But generally the idea is to, you know, mix the starter with about an equal amount of the beer, give it 24 hours, and then pitch that whole thing. So get ready the day before. And honestly, it makes bottling day easier because now you've got the yeast already rehydrated, already acclimated. You don't have to go through that whole process. At the same time, you're cleaning bottles and setting everything up. And that's just, it's a great way to ensure you're going to get a quick fermentation, which will also help to protect the beer from oxygen. It will help to prevent the Brettanomyces. Sometimes will kick off like a weird, like a weird secondary fermentation where it then produces a lot of weird byproducts, like tetrahydropyridine, which is that sort of like toasty flavor that some people call mousy.
Sounds delicious. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's this, to me, I pick up as like a weird, it tastes like I just ate a bowl of Cheerios, that like weird lingering cereal grainy sort of flavor. And it's one of the worst things you can do is learn to identify it, because you'll start tasting it in kettle sours and American sour beers, pale sour beers in particular. It usually goes away. The Brett will eventually clean it up. But again, if you're hoping the beer is going to be ready soon, having a big, healthy, quick, active fermentation is the best thing you can do for it.
Nice. Well, do you have any additional tips you picked up since you wrote American Sour Beers?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird being at this, you know, coming from a home brewing background and opening a brewery where I helped out at breweries like Modern Times before we opened, but this was sort of my first time brewing at this scale. I was never a head brewer anywhere. I was never a keg washing intern. And honestly, the same sort of things for sour beer apply to just, you know, making hoppy beers or stouts or whatever. Almost all the science is the same. I mean, the same sorts of, you know, the same mash temperature gets the same sorts of results, the same pitching rates. You know, you're just scaling things differently when you're doing the recipe and you're, you know, trying to make recipes that, you know, have whole sacks of grain rather than 40 pounds out of this sack and 38 pounds out of that sack. But it's really just sort of the physics of the whole thing. You know, how do you move 300 gallons of beer? You know, that's a lot of weight, a lot of pressure, a lot of speed. And it's sort of the same thing with sour beer. You know, I used to just do fruit by, you know, going to the farmer's market and cutting up 5 pounds of peaches and put them in a carboy and or a bucket and siphon fermented sour beer onto it.
And now, just at this scale, do the same thing with 500 pounds, right?
You know, we actually do sometimes. And that's the sort of thing. You know, you can scale up cutting up peaches. What's harder is figuring out what kind of vessel to put them in and how to get that beer back off of the fruit again. You know, we're not big enough to have a centrifuge. We don't filter beer. What we've done is my partner Scott Janish has worked for a long time and gotten some custom stuff from Utah Biodiesel. And their original business was just that they were making these sort of stainless filters and screens for people to filter, you know, cooking grease. Use the oil to run their car or whatever.
Biodiesel, right?
Exactly. And the same sorts of things work great for getting fruit out. And so we've got a bunch of big plastic winemaking totes that we put the fruit into. We purge them with CO2, and then we transfer the beer from the barrel onto there and let it re-ferment and then take it back out. There's a little racking arm, and we have a stopper with one of these little screens stuck on top of it. And it works pretty well, and we haven't had anything sort of jam up. We actually had the most problem with a batch that had puree. It was a heavily apricoted beer.
I don't use puree anymore for that exact reason.
Yep.
I'd rather use wine base or fruit or almost anything else.
Exactly. And we hadn't had trouble with it in our real fermenters for sort of, you know, beers, because we can chill the whole thing. It's got a conical, and we can dump the fruit out the bottom. And we tried and we put a screen on, and the puree was too thick and it plugged up the screen, and then we had to come out and we had to transfer back and forth between about three different tanks just to get most of the puree out. And we ended up with some kegs that were about half puree. And it's just like, you know, it was a valuable lesson to learn that puree is not that great unless you have a way to pull off above it. And yeah, I really didn't use puree much at home because the losses, you know, you'd add a bunch of puree and you'd end up with you know, a third of your batch was gunk.
Yeah, I don't use it at all actually anymore.
Yeah. So we now use, I mean, when it's in season, we try to get fresh and local, but we'll use dried fruit and we've used juice and citrus zest and, yep, as you said, almost anything other than puree.
Yeah.
But no, most of the things at this scale, yeah, it's just like learning how to move things around and, you know, dealing with, you know, I had two big barrels at home and now we've got 65 of them. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, learning that, for us now, it's really blending is the big difference at home. Blending was something I did very rarely because I just didn't have, you know, four different carboys of the same sour beer that I could pick and choose from. And not only blending to flavor, but then having to worry about, if you're blending one barrel that has a higher gravity and one with a lower, you know, how much fermentation are you going to expect in the bottle? You know, do you need
to
undercarbonate to leave room for that? Or, what do you, you've got four barrels of this beer. Do you want to blend the two best ones to make a really terrific beer and leave the two mediocre barrels? Do you want to throw them out? Do you want to put those onto fruit? Do you want to those sorts of things? And for us, sort of generally, the rule is bad beer goes down the drain. Great beer gets bottled as is. And beer that, say, isn't sour enough maybe goes onto fruit, but it's otherwise very good. Because fruit, as we talked about, is great at adding some acidity, and it's will feed the microbes, and it has acid, and it just... and it adds some interest. If your beer is a little boring, it's a way to give it a little, a unique character.
Well, we're actually coming up to the end of our time, Michael, but I wanted to give you a minute or two, just say a little bit about Sapwood Cellars, maybe tell folks where you are, how to get their website and so on. Sure. And that's about it.
Yeah, no, it's weird just doing something like this every day. And we've been lucky so far that, you know, we're in like a random office park in Columbia, Maryland. We aren't allowed to have much of a sign out by the street. And luckily, thanks to Google and my blog and my partner, ScottJanish.com, Scott's blog, people find us. People come out of their way. We've got a cool tasting room. We've got a great staff. A bunch of homebrewers work here part-time, and our bar manager is a homebrewer. And
folks may not know, where's Columbia, too? Not too far from Baltimore.
We're not too far off of 95, but we're sort of between Baltimore and D.C.,
right.
So if you're ever sort of driving up 95 is sort of the, you know, East Coast corridor from Boston to, I don't know, Florida, somewhere, I assume. We're right off of there. We're very close to BWI Airport. So if you ever happen to be flying in or out of the area, we're not quite as close as the gigantic Guinness factory that's right there. But we are one of the closest breweries to BWI. And most, if not all, of our beer is usually served from the tap room. That's where the margins are. And as a former economist, I couldn't justify making $50 a keg, sending kegs out the door. So we sell pints over the bar and bottles to go, and hopefully very soon cans to go. We're getting some new tanks, and hopefully we'll regularly have packaged beer to go. So it's been an adventure so far. It's only been a year and a half.
Well, Michael, really appreciate you being on the show. Thanks again for coming and talking about some of the things you learned about sour beers. Great to have you here today.
Yeah, my pleasure. And timing worked out perfectly. About 8 minutes from now, my old homebrew buddy is coming to blend Dark Saison with me.
Nice. Well, again, my guest today was Michael Tonsmeyer. He's the author of the book, American Sour Beers, and also has a brewery called Sapwood Cellars, which you can find in Columbia, Maryland. Thanks again, Michael.
Yep. Thanks, Brad.
A big thank you to Michael Tonsmeyer for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the BrewEasy. Brew big in small spaces with the best all-grain ultra-compact system available. The BrewEasy's revolutionary setup combines batch barge efficiency, brew-in-a-bag simplicity, and the work clarification of a rim system. It's easy to set up, easy to operate, and easy on the eyes. Electric and propane models are available. It's also the system that I personally brew on. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And Beersmith 3 is available on both desktop and mobile platforms. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider support, new Whirlpool hop options, support for high-altitude beer brewing, and a whole lot more. Check out Beersmith 3 and get your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.